A University of Arkansas associate professor in the Department of Geosciences, who was part of a research team that studied the first theropod dinosaur trackways found in Arkansas, will give a lecture this week about that discovery. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek spoke with Selena Suarez about her work and what it's like to uncover a previously unknown species of raptor.
This week you'll be giving a lecture about a discovery in 2011. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
Sure. So back in 2011, this was just before I got here, but I had been hired. A gypsum mine down south near Dirks discovered some dinosaur tracks. And dinosaur tracks have been known from this gypsum mine in the past. Back in the 80s, some folks discovered some sauropod tracks. It's actually a really well-known sauropod track, but nobody's ever found three-toed tracks at that site. And so the mine operators had seen it. They call them potholes because the sauropod tracks are big, round tracks from big, long-necked dinosaurs, and they just call them potholes. But one of the mine operators noticed a track that was really different than these other tracks and had said, oh, I've never seen one of these tracks before. It looks like a T-Rex track or something like that. So he sent a picture over to the department over the summer. And over the summer, there's hardly anybody in the department because everybody's either off doing research or teaching field courses. And so it came across my email from one of the faculty members who was in town. I'm like, wow, that's cool. It's a theropod track. And then I saw a picture with scale. I'm like, wow, that's a really big theropod track. Where is this from? And so I came down over the summer. It was really, really hot. And I had a colleague who was finishing up his PhD at the University of Kansas, and now he's a professor at University of Mississippi who's a track expert, also came down. And so the mine operators allowed us to work in that area for about 2 weeks. And so we devised a plan to get over there, document as many tracks as possible, both by hand and then by LIDAR. So we used LIDAR equipment from CAS, the Center for Advanced Spatial Technologies, to basically scan what was almost the size of like 2 football fields of dinosaur tracks. And it was a whole long, big layer, lots of sauropod tracks and several theropod trackways. Most likely the track maker for the theropod track was Acrocanthosaurus, because it is the main very large meat-eating two-legged dinosaur during this time period. And ironically, we find that animal everywhere in the U.S. We find it in Wyoming, we find it in Utah, we find it in Texas. It's originally from Oklahoma, like the first specimen was from Oklahoma, obviously here in Arkansas. There's evidence of it in along the East Coast. So, yeah, that's part of the interesting thing about this whole study is that the diversity of dinosaurs in this early part of the Cretaceous around 110, 120 million years ago was really low. There were only a few very top predators, and a lot of the animals across the U.S. were really similar. And those animals also had similarity to animals in Europe. So,
what did this dinosaur look like?
The Acrocanthosaurus? Yes. So it would be similar to T-Rex, Tyrannosaurus rex, but it's a different animal. It's a little bit more slender, very slimmer size, has three fingers, not two. Tyrannosaurus rex has 2 fingers, and probably had more grasping fingers that were useful for grasping, but would be, you know, about the length of a short bus, a couple of meters at least at the hip. And I think we made some reconstruction. I think it was somewhere around 2 meters, our reconstruction from the foot size and the stride length. You can estimate the height at the hip. There's various equations that you can use to estimate that. So yeah, it would have been big animal, teeth that were about 1.5 inches-ish, serrated on both sides. So it wouldn't be somebody you would want to wander across, you know, back in the Cretaceous.
Right, if you were one of those other dinosaurs that were probably herd animals, right?
Yeah, the sauropods were probably herd animals, yeah.
And I guess it would make sense that that meat-eating dinosaur would be sort of hanging out in that area.
Yeah. And that area of Arkansas was like a tidal flat, so it was close to the coast, probably fairly dry environment, like Sabka, I think kind of like a Middle East, Sabkas, shallow seas. And so these guys would have been walking around on like a carbonate beach. They probably were plants back off in the distance. So, but these animals probably followed the coastline because we have those sauropod tracks as well as theropod tracks all the way back into Texas. And so we can kind of trace the paleo coastline, the paleo Gulf coastline into the Cretaceous. And they probably were migrating like east to west approximately.
This was the first, these were the first theropod tracks found in Arkansas. So why is this important and what does it tell you about Arkansas?
So the formation that these tracks are in is called the Duquesne Limestone. And it's basically the same limestone that you see like in Texas where you have Dinosaur Valley State Park and the famous Paluxy River dinosaur tracks as well as the Glen Rose Formation where you also have some famous dinosaur tracks from like the 20s. And so this basically gives us a good idea about the paleogeography and the paleobiogeography during this time period. So the rocks here, you know, rocks don't end at state boundaries. They continue on. They just maybe have different names. And so it helps connect the story and the paleogeography of where these dinosaurs were, where they were walking around, what they were doing, and helps give us an idea of behavior as well. Tracks are one of the few things that allow us to imply behavior because you can see if in this trackway, for example, we have two sauropod trackways that follow side by side with each other and turn together, which is really cool. So you know these animals were walking next to each other at the same time. And so it gives us that information as well. So behavioral information, paleogeography information. And it even helps us even from a global perspective because we see similar trackways in other places throughout the U.S. and in Europe and Spain. So it gives us an idea of the paleogeography and how things were connected back in the Cretaceous.
So this was found in a quarry. Mm-hmm. So you go in, you do your study of the tracks, you take photos, measurements, casts. Mm-hmm. What happens from there? I mean, it's a mine. So do they just mine through that material and those tracks disappear?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I think it probably was exploded about a month after we were there, which is a bit sad. But we have the LIDAR scan, so and it's all geo-referenced, so it has GPS location for everything. So we have it preserved digitally. The good thing about this mine is that they basically strip mine layer by layer for the gypsum. And so this one limestone layer and a large swath of that limestone layer was preserved. So if the mine wasn't there, we probably would never see these trackways. They'd be covered.
So not your first time working on a first. You were also part of, you and your sister discovered you were part of the team that studied the new, unknown species of raptor in 2004. So
yeah.
Can you tell us about that? I mean, sure. How did that come about? What was that like to...
Really exciting.
Yeah, I bet.
It's like every dinosaur nerd's dream. I was working on my master's degree at Temple University at the time, and I was working with the State Paleontology of Utah, Jim Kirkland, and we were excavating a site that has... a troodontid dinosaur. It's a small two-legged theropod dinosaur. We were excavating a large kind of mass mortality of this animal. And that was part of both of our master's research. We had different aspects working on that quarry site. And as part of that research, my sister and I were mapping one of the rock layers that the quarry was in. And we had been following the layer out for a couple of miles. And we had seen a really nice cut through a gully that we could look at the layers of the rock. And we managed to go down into that gully. And lo and behold, there was just bone everywhere poking out of the rock layer. And then we went and prospected laterally from that. And we could see more bones popping out, some theropod bones and some ankylosaur bones, some ankylosaur scutes, like the little dermal plates. And so we hightailed it back to to the quarry site and we're like, hey, guys, we found a really cool site. You got to come check it out. So the next morning we went and checked it out. And this new dinosaur that we found was a troodontid, probably the oldest troodontid in North America, actually in the world, I think, actually. And they ended up, my colleagues ended up naming it Gemini Raptor Swatus Arum, which is, when they first told me, I'm like, that's cute. And they're like, no, seriously, we're going to name it Gemini Raptor Swatus Arum. And I'm like, are you serious? Really? I'm like, oh, that's cool. Great. Okay.
Right. So, before
but,
you
yeah,
and your sister.
Yeah, Gemini, because we're twins. And yeah. So Gemini Raptor and then Swatus Arum is the Latin feminine plural.
So how were you able to tell that this is a different species?
They did it based off of the morphology of the skull.
Okay.
And found that it was not like anything else that has been discovered in North America and in rocks that are quite old. And so based off of that, they determined that it was a new genus and species.
When we talk about finding tracks or fossils, how much of it is luck?
I'd say about 75-25. There's a good, maybe a little better, 60-40 maybe. A good part of it is knowing the type of rock and the age of the rock that you're interested in and how good the outcrop is. If there's lots of cover, that's usually not good. And trying to find something in that is, I mean, if you really want to find something, you want to go somewhere where it's dry, desert, there's no plants, it has the correct age rock and the correct type of rock that are the depositional environment that the rock formed in was an environment that, if you're looking for dinosaurs would be living in. If you're looking for swimming reptiles, you're looking for rock that is a marine rock that swimming reptiles would have been living in. So that is all knowledge that you can plan ahead and find maps and just start wandering about, and then the rest of it is pretty much luck.
What's the hardest part about studying something that lived so long ago based on these kind of, definitely a lot of clues, but a lot of it is trying to piece those clues together.
Yeah. The scant clues is the biggest problem. You see little, like I said before, that, you know, there was definitely an east-west connection between, the Western Interior Basin, between Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, into Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Maryland. We see all these clues and trying to piece them together and come up with a comprehensive idea of why they're connected and how they were connected. That is a little bit difficult. And then the other difficulty is, like in Utah, it's great. There's desert everywhere, and so you can find these things fairly well preserved. And there's lots of public land that we can work on. Whereas in places like Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas, there's a lot of private land, and the outcrop is not as good. So it limits. I would say there's endless possibilities for some of the early Cretaceous material in Arkansas, but most of it is covered by plants. And those exposures that aren't covered by plants are usually in creek beds, but those creek beds are usually in somebody's private property. And so then you have to get permission from those property owners to explore around on their land. And not everybody wants you wandering around on their land. So
why is research into these creatures that lived so long ago important for you now?
So most of my research nowadays has been focused on greenhouse worlds. So in the geologic history, there have been time periods that we had overall higher global temperatures and overall higher CO2 conditions. And not, well, for some people, surprisingly, but for others, not unsurprisingly, these are the directions that we're headed. For whatever reason you want to give it, these are the directions that we are headed, overall higher CO2 and overall higher temperatures within a fairly short time period. Probably in 300 years, we'll be in conditions similar to what we were in the Cretaceous, which is a bit mind-boggling because that was about 100 million years ago. And so part of the importance of that and part of the reason why it really gets me jazzed to do what I do is understanding how the entire Earth system operated under those higher CO2 conditions and higher greenhouse temperature conditions, and how that affects the evolution of animals, how that affects climate from the poles to the equator, And so that's kind of, and for me, I mostly focus on land, so continental deposits. And so that itself has its own challenges. We're basically trying to reconstruct these climates over time and understand as we go into these greenhouse events, what happens to life on Earth. And in some instances, you have mass extinctions, like in the end of the Triassic or at the end of the at the beginning of the Triassic. The Triassic is bracketed by extinctions. And then in other instances, like the Cretaceous, where we have overall higher temperatures, we don't really see an extinction. And so understanding why you have extinction and why you don't have extinction are part of why the rocks here in Arkansas, these Cretaceous age rocks, are playing a big part now in my research.
That was Selena Suarez, an associate professor in the University of Arkansas Department of Geosciences, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. She'll be giving her lecture tomorrow evening at 7 at the Arkansas Archaeological Survey Building on Hatch Avenue. The event is free. It's open to the public. A sampling of plaster casts will also be on display during her program.